This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. The place is the political realm, an election happening right now. The people, millions of eligible voters in America, 8 million in California alone, who have the power as a group to sway a race.
Both campaigns are really relying on the Latino vote here to pull through.
The biggest and fastest growing demographic in America, Latino.
Real question is, will the Latino community turn out?
Most of them Democrats, according to the exit polls from 2016.
There's a misperception of Hispanics being Democrats, but there's a young generation of young conservatives that are trying to change that.
Yes, the Latino vote is very important, particularly in some swing states such as Florida, Arizona, Nevada, where millions have already voted. Here in cobalt blue California, the Latino vote could be pivotal in close races like the ones here in Southern California in Orange County, and will continue to be pivotal in America's political future. Randall Avila is executive director of the Orange County Republican Party, and Ada Briceño is chair of the Orange County Democratic Party. And I want to welcome you both.
Thank you so much
Thank you for having me.
Randall, I'm going to start with you. Latino voters skew Democratic in most parts of the country, certainly here in Southern California. That fact has been a driving force and a huge political shift that's taken place in what has been pretty red Orange County, to the point where now the OC no longer has even a single Republican member of Congress. What do you see as the issues that can move more of those local voters back into the Republican column, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to first start off by saying that, you know, this year, more so than others, I've seen the Republican Party try even harder than ever before to reach out to the Latino community. And we're seeing some great feedback and great response so far. And some of the issues that, you know, Latino voters in Orange County are responding to, number one is just the economic success. So we've seen under President Trump and under Republicans, you've seen Latinos, you know, really get a lion's share of the new jobs that have been created. You've seen some of the lowest unemployment for Latinos in American history under this administration. You're also seeing Latinos respond to us on educational opportunity, giving more and more Latino minority families the opportunity to go to schools of their choice, schools that make sense to them, instead of you know, leaving them to failing schools where, you know, they're not able to get ahead if they're forced to stay there just based on their zip code. And I'd say the third thing that Latino voters are responding to here in this county is public safety. I mean, I think we've seen it all over the headlines and all over the news, where, you know, we have a very different position from our opponents, where we want to defend our police, where our opponents want to, you know, really defund the police. And public safety is becoming a big concern in Orange County and across the state and across the nation.
Historically, you know, the GOP has been against affirmative action. And obviously, you mentioned schools. The GOP has been against allowing affirmative action in colleges. How do you jibe that with trying to get the Latino vote, though?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when you talk about educational choice and school choice, we're talking about K through 12 education. So I think we need to take a step back and really focus on building up those fundamentals and making sure that Latino students, just like myself, my little brothers, who one of them is in high school right now, you know, they deserve an opportunity to get those, that great education and an education of their choice, by their parents, by themselves, to make sure that they are able to build up that foundation and be able to, you know, get more opportunities in higher education, or whether it be vocational training of their choice. And so, you know, we support a lot of common sense things that are going to help more and more Latinos and minority students get into great colleges. But we don't think that affirmative action is the answer. In fact, I think to some degree that could hurt Latinos and different minority groups when you start putting caps based off of race and not based off of, you know, their abilities, the, you know, their test scores, and, you know, those fundamentals that we owe it to our students in K through 12 to be able to provide to them.
Ada, there seems to be a pretty significant gender split right now. The majority of Latinos are Democrats, but there's a strong and perhaps growing contingent of young Latino men who voted for Trump in 2016 and say they plan to do it again. What do you think the appeal is for them?
You know, I know that that's what the polling says, but, you know, I really believe that it's going to come back differently. You know, I know that women are definitely for Biden. And I think it's, you know, because of everything that we're seeing around us as we speak. We see a lot of Latinas who are losing, who have lost their jobs due to the pandemic. disproportionately, you know, a lot of women, Latinas, you know, in the service industry are losing their jobs, you know, in restaurants, hotels, housekeeping. So I think we still have a race to see here. And I'm not so sure that they're all for Trump.
Latinx voters don't seem particularly thrilled by Joe Biden, though. He has been criticized for not reaching out to the Latino community. His polling is falling a bit short of Latino support for Clinton, Hillary Clinton in 2016. That could be a problem for Democrats in close races, couldn't it?
Well, look, we have seen that Joe Biden will fight to ensure, you know, affordable health care. He did it, you know, under Obama. He's going to continue to do that. You know, he cares about the issues of Latinos. He will raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour so Latinos can support their families. You know, Trump has a horrible record. He doesn't even know what he's going to do with health care. It is a problem for the Latino community. Health care is a crucial issue for Latinos. He's going to invest in education to make sure that, you know, a person's zip code doesn't, you know, determine their future. He is firm on immigration policy that has to provide a pathway to citizenship and just return dignity and respect for our immigrant communities.
Randall, there's obviously a painful history when it comes to the Republican Party and Latinos here in California. We go back to the mid-1990s, Pete Wilson, then governor, Prop 187, which tried to deny public services to undocumented immigrants. It passed, but did not pass constitutional muster beyond that. How do you convince people, given the past and given the rhetoric by President Trump, you know, when he came down the escalator in 2015 and said he was running for president and started by saying, well, some Mexicans are, you know, rapists and not, you know, drug dealers and things like that. I mean, how do you overcome that? And how do you tell people, Latinos in particular, hey, there's a place for you in this party?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that when you, you know, reference some of that polling and you see that his support amongst the Latino community has not wavered whatsoever, and some polls are suggesting that he's actually gaining. I think it's because Latino voters see beyond the sound bites. And I think Latinos also see how his presidency and his administration has affected them. When you look at the economy, a 3.9% unemployment before COVID for Latino community, one of the lowest in history. When you look at the median household income for Latinos raising by over $1,700 annually, we're seeing some incredible gains for ourselves personally. And I think those voters and our Latino community are looking at that and saying, I'm going to look beyond the sound bites. I'm going to look beyond what's said in the headlines. And I'm actually going to see how this presidency has affected me and my pocketbook and my family. And they are seeing across the country, you know, if you want to talk about divisiveness, we can talk about the things that are going on in our streets, in public safety, where, you know, Latino communities are affected greatly by some of these public policy mistakes that the Democrats have made, whether it be the fact that they have released in California thousands of prisoners early, whether it's the fact that, you know, they have passed policies that allow, you know, these lower, you know, they're redefining what offenses are higher crimes and which are lower. And, you know, they're releasing people who have done horrible things. And so I think Latinos are looking at what Democrat policies mean for their communities and their neighborhoods.
What do you say to that, Ada?
Yeah, it's not just sound bites. It's not results. The Latino community is hurting right now. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about results. They're out of work. They're impacted by COVID. I have people I know as a leader of a union that are dying every single day, hotel workers that are dying, their family members that are dying. And it's because Trump has decided to handle the pandemic in the way that it has. The economic recovery will not include the regular Americans, the Latinos in our country. It is a problem. Latina women are already set back. And the recovery will not include them under Trump. So results and actions, I beg to differ. I live in a different America than Randall lives in. I got to say, we see the forced, the news of the forced sterilizations of Latinas in detention center, the inhumane treatment of them. We see Republicans trying to stifle the vote, their vote, by creating fake ballots. And, you know, Trump trying to take away the trust in the American process in our democracy by saying that the post office doesn't work. I don't know what world Randall is living. Definitely not the experience that I have with, you know, hundreds and thousands of families across Orange County, Los Angeles, and Arizona. And my experience with the Latino community in the past 30 years has not been what he's speaking about at all.
I want to thank you both for talking with us today. Ada Briceño, chair of the Orange County Democratic Party, Randall Avila, executive director of the Orange County Republican Party. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, that was a lot to digest, obviously. So let's unpack a couple of things that were just said. For one thing, Randall Avila said that Democrats released thousands of inmates early for doing what he called horrible crimes. I guess that depends on what your definition of horrible is. In fact, people released or convictions reduced under Proposition 47, which was a statewide ballot measure, were nonviolent offenders, forgery, writing bad checks, drug crimes, theft. The crime rate overall did go up, but had been going up before Prop 47 passed. There has been an increase in property crime rates as well, but not a substantial increase since Prop 47 passed. And of course, the coronavirus has had something to do with that as well. Also, Ada Briceño said that the GOP is creating fake ballots. There's no evidence of widespread fake ballots, but perhaps she meant fake ballot drop-off boxes, which has been an issue in this election, something that the Attorney General and the Secretary of State are both addressing with Republicans who have been defiant up to now. There's more on the election, by the way, at kcrw.com/election2020. All right, so let's continue now with Greater LA and a closer look at a particular race in Orange County. That race is for the seat on the County Board of Supervisors for District 1, which includes the cities of Santa Ana, Garden Grove, Westminster. The incumbent is Republican Andrew Doe. The challenger is Democrat Sergio Contreras, a city councilman from Westminster. And Gustavo Arellano is here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
All right, so we've been talking about congressional races in the county, but this is a more local race. We're talking about the Board of Supervisors. Tell us about Doe and Contreras.
So Andrew Doe, incumbent, former council member in Garden Grove, part of the Republican Board of Supervisors. Four out of five currently are Republican. Of course, the Board of Supervisors this year has been under a lot of controversy over their response, or rather lack of response, to the coronavirus pandemic. Sergio Contreras, former school board member in Westminster, then became a council member. He's been there for a couple of years. Very popular among Democrats, young and obviously Latino. And yeah, he was able to beat longtime Santa Ana Mayor Miguel Pulido in the runoff earlier this year in the primary. So now he's going up against Andrew Doe. Andrew Doe only pulled 43% of all the votes, but of course he was an incumbent and the only Republican there.
We just heard, Gustavo, about the Latino vote in Orange County and beyond, by the way, across the country. How important do you think will that vote be in this race?
Oh, this is going to be huge because this is a supervisorial district where Latinos represent the majority of the people there. They're, or at the very least, a plurality. But they have never come out really to vote. And this is also the same district where you have a lot of Vietnamese who have just, you know, supported two separate supervisors. You had Janet Nguyen earlier, then Andrew Doe replaced her. And so the Democrats so want this district. Latinos so want this district. And they've run Latino candidates over the years, but they always lose because the Vietnamese political machine, they get their people out to vote, while the Latino political machine, well, there is no real Latino political machine in Orange County, so it's always an underperforming vote.
What are the issues that they're talking about? What are the talking points going on between the campaigns?
Of course, coronavirus, the big one. Andrew Doe says, hey, I'm not one of the bad supervisors, although, of course, he won't say it like that. But he says that he has tried everything possible to face off coronavirus and to try to bring back the economy in Orange County. Sergio Contreras, says no. Homelessness, of course, big issue. This is the most working class district of all the supervisorial districts in Orange County. So homelessness and really the economy right now. This is the area, of course, where you have a lot of people out of work. So Sergio Contreras says he's going to try to bring back jobs. So does Andrew Doe. In fact, Andrew Doe says, yeah, I've kept jobs. So it's going to be it's the same old, except coronavirus is really going to be the one that might get people upset.
How much does the fact that Doe is being investigated for money laundering, how does that play into this race? Obviously, Contreras is probably hammering it, right?
I am getting God knows how many flyers in my P.O. box. Both of you folks, please stop. I don't need no more flyers. But I don't really think it matters much. I mean, in Orange County, political corruption, for crying out loud, we had a former sheriff, Mike Corona, who he would have still probably won re-election if it wasn't for the fact that he got indicted and eventually convicted on one felony. I mean, and then again, in 2018, Tony Rakakis, because of the whole, you know, the whole cloud of the snitch scandal around him, finally brought him down against Todd Spitzer. But I really think in this election between Andrew Doe and Sergio Contreras, it really doesn't matter much at all.
Doe won his seat by a very slim margin 6 years ago. Does it look like it's going to be that close again this time around?
Again, it depends on the Vietnamese vote and the Latino vote. And this is actually a rivalry going back now, geez, more than a decade in these particular districts, in the congressional districts, anywhere where there's Vietnamese and Latino voters. And the Vietnamese politicians, they almost always beat the Latino politicians again and again and again. So especially the Democrats, they desperately want this seat. There's only been two Democrats on the Board of Supervisors in Orange County in the past, oh boy, I think it's the past 36 years, basically since the late 80s. And Republicans come again and again and again. There currently is a Democrat on the Board of Supervisors. So if Sergio's able to pull it off, then, hey, that makes two.
Well, let me ask you about that, because Democrats won every congressional seat in the OC 2 years ago. But the Board of Supervisors is majority Republican. How did that happen? And is that going to continue, do you think?
Well, I mean, we just heard both from Randall Avila and Ada Briseño a little bit about that. But what people, especially the national media, doesn't understand is that about 75% of the seats, of the elected seats in Orange County, still go to the Republican Party. And this is because the Republican Party, this was Reagan country. This was Nixon country. But slowly but surely, you're starting to see Democrats make gains on school board races, city council races, and the most important one now, the Board of Supervisors. If Sergio Contreras is able to pull this off, then yeah, then you're going to start seeing even more people running for these bigger races, and not just, you know, the big money elections like the congressional seats, and even to a lesser extent the state assembly and state senate seats.
Andrew Doe, of course, having the power though of the incumbency, which is a pretty big power, so we will see how it works out. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, every week he joins us for KCRW's Orange County Line. Thanks, Gustavo.
Gracias.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Los Angeles, and you know this, is in the midst of a long-running housing crisis. And one of the reasons for that is because it is super expensive to build affordable housing. So the folks who are interested in investing in more affordable options, the folks in development, well, they say the building industry needs disruption. A prime example of what that might look like is being tested out near Culver City. And KCRW's Francis Anderton, who covers design and architecture, talks more about it with us right now. Hey, Francis.
Hello, Steve.
Tell us about this. So a disruption, I mean, is this the gig economy making its way into housing?
That's one way of looking at it. It's certainly tech making its way into housing. As we know, tech loves to disrupt. And yes, indeed, the building industry, which is somewhat traditional, is I guess, getting some challenges. So anyway, let's talk about this project, Steve. Yes, if you put on your mask and you drive over to the Fox Hills area near Culver City, you can go to a yard up a small street, and there you will find a little structure, 350 square feet. street, to be precise. We're talking about a very clean, modern-looking structure. It's got a kitchen, a bath, a living room with a pull-down Murphy bed. It's made of, essentially, of two walls of glass and then two solid walls. And one of those walls curves over and becomes the roof of the structure. Now, what's interesting about it all is that some of this structure is 3D printed.
3D print, like the 3D printers that you see in Best Buy or a place like that, or well, a much bigger model would be needed to make this home, right?
That's exactly right. That Best Buy 3D printer that you're thinking of, yes, typically sits on the desk and dribbles out a little thread of a plastic-based liquid that might form itself into a model. Okay, yes, think of that made much bigger. There's a factory in Oakland that this Mighty Buildings works with, and there's a gigantic machine that prints out structures in what they call their proprietary material, a mixture of polymers and minerals. And they say that with that machine, you can form pretty much any shape of structure that you like. One of its goals is to do fancy looking structures. The other goals are to eliminate waste materials, make the building process more efficient. One of the investors in this company is an LA developer named Basil Starr, and he really believes in the, the disruptive nature of this. He says construction's been the same for centuries. It's time to move beyond old-fashioned materials like wood and concrete.
Well, we've been building the same way, you know, from the beginning of time, essentially, you know, by doing on-site construction, bringing all the materials, you know, to on-site construction. And the 3D printing is a totally different way, you know, of manufacturing. It is additive manufacturing where you're manufacturing exactly what you need and nothing more.
So how much will all of this cost then?
Well, Mighty Buildings says that if you have a flat backyard, this whole package, including appliances, AC and everything, could come in at around $115,000, $120,000. Now, I should say that flat is the operative word. Most of our backyards are not flat and ready to just plop a structure on. There's all sorts of foundation work that you have to do. There's permitting fees, there's delivery, and that can add quite substantial thousands of dollars to that basic fee.
But even with all of those costs integrated into the price, I mean, you mentioned $120K or, you know, even more, could that be an answer to the affordable housing crisis?
Well, let's just say that it certainly might make a small dent, and it certainly is causing, again, to use this word, disruption. It's causing people to think about how we build. What Mighty Buildings and this particular structure in Fox Hills represents is an example of an effort to prefabricate housing off-site. And this is a burgeoning field in LA right now. Like Basil Starr said, buildings have been built pretty much the same way for centuries. But since the advent of the car, there's been efforts to apply Henry Ford's mass production model to housing. And that is because construction is costly. There are high labor costs. It takes time. There is wastage of materials. This 3D printed building or shell is one example of several going on where firms are trying to prefabricate buildings off-site. The effort has heated up in recent years, in part because tech has got involved, and also because one of our new housing types that is permissible in LA now is the ADU, or accessory dwelling unit, or granny flat. And this has produced a gold rush to get these housing structures built. Some are coming in at market rate, and some are there are many efforts to try and make this kind of structure more affordable. So the Mighty Buildings example is just so far permitted for one story. It's aiming for two stories. But out there in the field are many other companies that are trying to apply the same kind of thinking to multi-story, multi-family. They're not there yet. To really be cost-effective, this approach has to be scaled up, like the Ford manufacture, the mass production of cars. But we're getting there. And if you talk to people in housing, they will say that even though there are still obstacles, it's not a reason for not trying. Specifically, one of those people is Charlie Ligety. He's director of the Housing Innovation Collaborative, which is a nonprofit housing-focused R&D platform here in LA. It's involved with trying to find ways to build more cost-effective housing in Los Angeles with its Rapid Shelter Innovation Showcase. And he says prefab has to be part of our construction future.
Be excited, but be very modified, like modify your excitement to an appropriate level, because it's a long path ahead, but it is the future. There needs to be a belief that standardizing processes, which factory housing does, is the future to actually meet the production that we need, given the scale of the housing crisis.
It's certainly a crisis that we've been talking about for a long time, and no doubt will be for a long time. KCRW's Francis Anderton, who covers design and architecture. Francis, as always, thanks.
You're so welcome, Steve.
It's KCRW's Power in Numbers Drive, by the way. Just a few seconds before we wrap up, there's 1 week to go to count yourself in. And you know, with Unity, we can achieve incredible things with your help. Time to speak up for what you believe in. We hope that includes KCRW and the folks here who help this station run each and every day. KCRW.com/give. And thank you for your support. That's going to do it for us this evening. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for tuning in. Have a good night.